I am Gillian Strain. Welcome to the Go Health Podcast. So we're in season two of the podcast, exploring learning to heal. That's a title, learning to heal. Double meaning there, explaining that by listening to the stories and experiences of others, we might be learning to heal ourselves. And or both, I don't know, learning to be a source of healing for others. So welcome to season two. If you haven't already done so, please rate and subscribe the podcast. Go on, click it right now, because this helps others to find us. And that's our whole mission, to share these conversations with as many people as possible. And we totally value your help in helping us meet this mission. In this episode, I am chatting with Nick Thorley, one of the founders and co-hosts of the legendary Nomad podcast. So he is a super experienced broadcaster and podcaster. And I will admit to you, I was a wee bit nervous. But as you will hear, he is a totally lovely guy. And I was really struck by his openness and his willingness to share some really tough aspects of his life. Nick lost his sight as a teenager and went on to struggle with addiction. And as he chats in this podcast, we cover some really deep topics. We look at shame. We talk about recovery, about life lived in openness and honesty, and how powerful that can be. And actually, that's a word that has stuck with me. Powerful. It's a powerful story of loss, of struggle, and of what happens when we live honestly with how things really are, rather than how we would like them to be or how others want us to be and to live. So in this episode, we are talking about several kinds of addiction, including addiction to pornography. Like with all episodes of the Go Health podcast, we are not shying away from honest discussions about what's really going on for people. But I'm just mentioning this here in the introduction to let you know that some of the details of this podcast are of a sensitive nature. All that said, here is my honest and helpful conversation with Nick Thorley on learning to heal. On with the episode. Nick, thank you so much for coming on the Go Health podcast. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks, Gillian. Yeah, no problem at all.
Our kind of standard question has been over the last few months, how has your pandemic been? So what's things been like where you are and how has it impacted on your life and your work?
Yeah, it's been okay. I've been very fortunate, really. I would have to say I actually changed jobs just as the first lockdown started. So having worked at Christian Aid for 8.5 years, I closed one laptop one afternoon on my kitchen table. And a few days later, opened a different laptop for the peace building charity Cord, for whom I work now. So I've been able to continue to work, and working from home has been okay. There's been a few ups and downs during that time. Definitely, like a lot of people, suffered a little bit with the kind of lack of social interaction at certain times. I was actually very pleased during the first lockdown, just because of my circumstances. I'm divorced and have my children who are now 9 and 11 a couple of days in the week and half the weekends. And we kind of juggled it around during the lockdown. So I was very pleased actually to at least be able to walk from my house to their house like every other day or something like that, and have somewhere else to go and be in a different four walls, and sometimes have a cup of tea with their mum before we did the transition. So that was good. And because my children are adopted, they actually really enjoyed first being off school for a long period of time and then being in school but being in very small classes as they were children of key workers. So it was so in that sense kind of feel really fortunate, you know, compared to so many people. My lockdown wasn't too bad, but I'm definitely enjoying things getting a bit more back to normal.
Yeah, it's funny with things. I keep thinking, you know, we're recording this in February 2020. I keep thinking, This time last year, I got two young kids as well, Nick, and I was homeschooling. And I have to say, it just about ended me. It was really tough. And I keep thinking, yeah, it's so much better this year. But this, it's still strange, isn't it? You know, things are beginning to open up and we're having to remember how to do normal life again. A lot of people are saying that they're finding it quite tiring and it's quite strange getting back to the normal.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And it's funny, isn't it? Because you have those, I've been experiencing that thing where some situations feel totally normal and then others are still quite restricted, so that sort of difference in experience is quite interesting as well. But yeah, in general, I'm just really enjoying being able to meet people again and go out for drinks and meals and not having to think too hard about it. Yeah
And it's renegotiating all the social interactions, because this time last year we were all doing the same thing, whereas now I feel that some people are really, they're hugging, they're in busy pubs, and yet others, I had a meeting with a guy last week and we had to be outside and he wasn't prepared to accept the risk indoors. So people are renegotiating.
Yeah,
again, it makes it more complicated, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah I spoke at a church last week in my work for Cord, and they are still in the midst of sort of transitioning back to meeting in person, but some of them are meeting in person and some of them aren't, and some feel uncomfortable about getting back together, and so they're kind of in this hybrid situation like a lot of churches are. Yeah, and I guess you just have to appreciate that different people for all kinds of reasons are in different places, aren't they? So
this is the next standard question, is tell us about your ministry and your mission, but you know, tell us about who you are and the things you've been through. You know, why, you know, I know why you're on the podcast, and I know why do you think you're on the podcast?
Yeah, that's quite a leading question, isn't it? Hopefully. what I think I'm on the podcast for is the same as you. Yeah, I don't know, mission and ministry, that's quite an interesting idea. So I'm a dad. I am a runner. I'm blind. I work as a fundraiser manager for a cool little charity. And I have had a very interesting faith journey over the last 6 or 7 years. And I'm also part of a podcast called Nomad, and shared a lot of my own experiences on that podcast in different ways. I lost my sight. It was kind of a gradual deterioration, and maybe we'll chat about that a little bit more. But yeah, I kind of lost my sight and developed addictive behavior, and eventually I never really came to terms with either. I didn't accept that I was living with addiction. Didn't really come to terms with being blind. And although, yeah, so I guess I was in denial, really. Thought I was coping really well, but all this stuff was going on. Eventually led to the breakdown of my marriage. And then I started a road to recovery, which was profound and life-changing. And I guess changed my perception of so much about myself and about life and about faith and God and everything. And so it's been a challenging road, and a road with lots of ups and downs, and I'm still on it, still kind of unfolding journey and unraveling story. But it's been a journey of incredible healing and wholeness and peace.
Tell me, I mean, you said you weren't born blind, but you went blind. How old were you? Were you a teenager?
Yeah, I was partially sighted when I was born, although no one knew about it until I was about five or six, and I stopped making progress with my reading at school. So when I was at school in the 80s, we had these Peter and Jane books, and you know, the first book said Peter on the first page, and the next page said Jane. And there was something about a dog and a ball. it was quite a slow moving story. Anyway, as the series went on, the text got smaller, and I just stopped being able to read. And famously, in our sort of family folklore, the head teacher of the little tiny primary school I went to in North Staffordshire, got my mum into school at the end of the day as she came to pick me up, and she said, Mrs. Thorley, your son's thick. And, and my mum said, no, he's not. But yeah, they just thought that I couldn't read very well, wasn't very clever. I have this vivid memory of sitting with them. I guess these days you would call her a teaching assistant. But this lady used to come in to help us read. And I remember sitting there and telling her that I couldn't read this page. And she said, oh, you can. And I remember going, no, I can't. And she said, oh, you can. And I remember tears forming in my eyes, because it's like really confusing when you're very small and an adult's telling you that you can do something and you're pretty sure you can't. Anyway, so we went to the hospital and they did some tests and they said that I got scars on my retina, that it wasn't degenerative, that it was something that had occurred during my mum's pregnancy. So they said, why didn't you tell us that you had German measles when you were pregnant? And my mum said, because I didn't. And they said, oh, you must have come into contact with someone who did. So it's a bit odd, really. And that put loads of stuff on my mum. My mum carried a lot of guilt around for many years because of that. And but we always understood it to be stable. So they always said it was stable. So I had this little mantra when I was a kid. Like I remember, like at school or whenever I met different people and I told them that I was partially sighted, I remember always saying, it'll never get better, but it'll never get better, but it won't get any worse. Mm. And I really kind of clung to that. That was like reassuring, bit of a security. So when I was 15, my sight deteriorated in my right eye, like over the course of a weekend. Mm. So my right eye used to be the stronger of the two. So sometimes to see more clearly, I would close my left eye and I'd see with more clarity. But over the course of a weekend, I remember being at a football match in the afternoon and standing behind the goal. And I thought that my lens on my right, like my right lens of my glasses, was scratched. And I kept wiping it. And then I went to a church thing on the Saturday night and the same thing happened. And then on the Sunday morning, I was taking part in a drama at church. And I remember like looking at the piece of paper with the script on it. It just looked like a blank piece of paper. Mm. Whereas like 2 days before I'd been able to read it. So yeah, we went to the hospital and the consultant who'd seen me before had retired and we saw this new person and he said, oh, this was always a possibility. And we were really surprised and said, oh, we didn't think it was. So yeah, that was the first deterioration. And then it was very gradual then, probably in my late teens, early 20s when I was 24. So I could only see out my left eye by now. When I was 24, I just noticed, I was a youth worker for a group of Methodist churches at the time, and I just started to notice that my sight was getting more cloudy. And it was only, I guess, each Sunday part of my thing was to do the kids talk on a Sunday morning, and I just over the months began to find it harder and harder to orientate myself like to the congregation to make sure I was standing in the right place. And occasionally like the minister would come and just kind of like just turn me because I was like facing to the side or something like that. I just found it really hard. And so we kind of worked out this routine where they put a white piece of paper on the dark carpet so I could stand on it. And it was weird because it was only over a period of time that I realized it was getting worse. Anyway, so I went for some tests and they said that it might be to do with cataracts. And they could do an operation, but they didn't give any guarantees. So they did the operation, but it didn't improve it. And at that time, that's when they started talking about me having retinitis pigmentosa, which is a degenerative condition, which they'd never talked about that. I don't know why, no idea why it was misdiagnosed. But the understanding now is that I always had retinitis pigmentosa, which is degenerative, which is nothing to do with German measles. It's a genetic condition. So all kinds of weird stuff said early on that, yeah. And retinitis pigmentosa, or RP, as it's called for short, there are various kinds. So it can be to do with your blood. It can do with, it can be hereditary. But in my case, they think it's just a genetic mutation that happened when I was conceived because there's no history of sight loss in my family. Mm. And yeah, so when I was 28, that was about that time when I lost any sight. I could see light and dark for a bit, but by my early 30s, I couldn't see whether it was light or dark. So yeah, that's it.
And gosh, being a teenager as well, such an important developmental time. We're working out who we are. Do you think the age that you had a sudden deterioration, do you think that had an impact on, you know, coming to terms with what you had to live with?
I think it did, as I think back now. But at the time, and up until 6 or 7 years ago, I would have said not. So the thing is that I was, I suppose my way of coping, I suppose as I think back on it now, there are probably two ways of coping. One was my faith and one was addictive behavior. So in terms of my faith, I had a very strong faith and relationship with Jesus as I understood it. And so I would talk a lot about how I'd never been healed physically, but I'd been healed of any emotional pain, and it wasn't to do with self-pity. I guess the whole thing was kind of a mega sort of positivity, a sort of quite an aggressive positive attitude. I always used to tell the story of when I came back from that hospital trip when I was 15, when my right eye deteriorated. And I remember coming home and praying in my bedroom and listening to a U2 song called Ultraviolet Light. Like when this song kicks in, it says, at the start of the song, sorry, it says, sometimes I feel like, I don't know, sometimes I feel like checking out. I want to get it right. Can't always be wrong, and loving won't be long. And then it kicks in, and there's this really driving bass line and a throbbing rhythm. And it says, oh, sugar, don't you cry. Oh, child, wipe the tears from your eye. You know, I need you to be strong, and the day's as dark as the night is long. Feel like trash, you make me feel clean. I'm in the black, can't see or be seen. Baby, 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 light my way. And for so many years of my life, I talked about listening to that song. I'm feeling this like sort of, I don't know, like positive anger, like this kind of aggressive, this isn't going to get me down and I'm going to keep going. And I can either at this point roll over and die, or I can live. And I suppose in some ways that worked. Like people say things work until they don't work. That somehow, in some way, that was my attitude. So you see, you saying that about my teeth, that makes perfect sense, that like that would have a massive impact. But the way I thought about it consciously, I didn't think like that. I thought, I'm not going to get down about this. I guess I felt that if I let myself dwell in self-pity, that would overcome me. And so I needed to stay positive. And yeah, that was all wrapped up. My parents were very positive as well from an early age. So the doctors had said from an early age that I shouldn't ride a bike, for example. They said I'd never be able to drive, and they said I shouldn't ride a bike. But my dad was a keen cyclist, and he said that I should ride a bike. I went to mainstream school. I didn't go to like special school or anything like that. And I suppose the one of the things that I always took pride in was when people said, oh, you don't act like a blind person. It was almost like not like being like a sighted person was sort of the biggest compliment anybody could pay me. So as I look back now, it sort of feels a bit mixed up and a bit unhealthy, but at the time it's sort of half semi worked.
Yeah, and it's how we cope with things at the time. I think it's interesting you're talking there about positive anger and wanting to look not like what you're going through, and it chimes with my experience of cancer and trying to look not like a cancer patient. And some of the language, I wonder, I mean, often in cancer illness there's a big argument over what kind of language you should use.
Right. And yeah.
A lot of times you say, you know, the war language, the war metaphor isn't helpful. You fight, you've got to fight against this. A lot of people with cancer don't like that metaphor. But you're right, there is a lot of positivity. There's a lot to be said for taking a positive approach to solving problems. And because the Bible's also full of that, isn't it? You know, people rising to the challenge of what they've got to go through and battling it on. But it sounds like me, you're describing this was just a surface way of coping, and there was other deeper stuff going on for you, that the positive approach, the positive anger, as you call it, wasn't quite meeting.
Yeah, I mean, like, again, at the time I would have said it was, because I always like I did well at school, and I was had really good friends and had a good life. I enjoyed my childhood. I was really involved in church. I was kind of, you know, used to, from quite a young age as a teenager, started to preach and talk and, you know, do talks and helped to lead a youth group. And then I learned to play the drums, and then I was in a band, and then I got a job as a youth worker and all of that. You know, on the surface, it was all kind of, and if anybody said, and again, a kind of, I guess, a coping mechanism was people saying, oh, wow, you know, you do all this stuff. Isn't it amazing? You know, there's so much going on. But even now, I kind of look back and I think actually a lot of that was, especially with the kind of preaching and teaching type stuff, it's very controlled. Like you're at the front and you can speak and no one's going to interrupt you, and there's no sort of interaction. And I kind of look back to that now and think that actually, rather than that being a great sign of confidence, it was sort of quite a protected sort of thing. So a lot of people who aren't into public speaking always think that people who are good at public speaking are like uber confident, but that's not the case. Yeah. So,
definitely.
And this is why the kind of last 6 or 7 years have been so interesting and at times traumatic, but ultimately very healing, because it's sort of pulled away my whole understanding of myself and things that I thought were signs of confidence and coping. I sort of now realize were perhaps like not that, were ways of controlling and dealing with what was going on, like coping in a way that wasn't so healthy. Yeah.
So when did you first become aware that that addiction was part of your coping? Is there a moment when you think, because addictions don't just come from nowhere, they build up, I imagine. Was there a moment when you thought, this is an addiction and it might not be healthy?
That's a really good question. I think that it was much later in my life. So to kind of give it some context, from my adolescence, I suppose in puberty and stuff, I started to develop addictive sexual behavior. So I guess it started, we did this project on newspapers at school and we had to compare different kinds of newspapers, and I came across Page 3 for the first time and then found these phone numbers in the back of the newspaper that were like sex lines and started phoning them. And it became something that I just did like obsessively. And there were times when, we got a massive phone bill and my mum and dad, like, you know, were shocked and very angry. And, but it carried on because I started doing it at my grandmother's house. And then that, it sort of went from there and all the way through my teens. And I guess like, that sort of stuff. And occasionally buying like pornographic magazines and videos and masturbating. And it was sort of like what it was a behavior that some people, I'm trying to think how you describe it. I suppose the big feature, and I kind of understood this through the therapy that I had a number of years ago, was that it was deeply shameful. And so I, as a Christian, I really believed that what I was doing was really wrong and really bad, that sex outside of marriage was bad, that lusting and, you know, entertaining lustful thoughts, that was all really bad. But I just, like, I couldn't stop doing it. So I carried on doing it. So in answer to your question, when did I didn't regard it as addictive behavior. I didn't regard it as addiction, possibly until even when my marriage was like crumbling, because trust, you know, in later life, it kind of changed a little bit into phoning like, adult sort of dating chat lines and exchanging inappropriate messages like texts and emails with people. And it was all kind of on a screen. So although I would swap texts with people and emails, I didn't really ever want to meet up with anyone because I wasn't really interested in that necessarily. It was more just kind of pushing the boundaries in a sort of fantasy world. And because of the shame and the guilt, I would like, you know, on, if it's on a screen, you can control it. And then when opportunities arose to meet someone, I'd sort of back out of it. But even when my marriage was looking like it was going to end, I still had this idea that it was to do with being, I don't know, like, remembering conversations with people, you know, talking about being highly sexed or, yeah, it was kind of very much thinking about this. You've developed this behavior. It's immoral. It's wrong. Need to stop doing it. It's kind of bad. Towards the end of my marriage, I started doing some online gambling as well. And that's probably the time when I was doing that, that's probably the time when I thought I was involved in something that was addictive. Because I really couldn't stop doing that. I mean, I couldn't stop doing the other thing, but I don't know, there was something about the gambling that felt more immediately addictive. And so it wasn't until I started doing therapy. I had various bits of therapy and counseling throughout my marriage. But when my marriage came to an end and I was kind of forced into a situation where I just could not, like something, I had to do something. I say I had to do something. I was seeing a counselor that I'd seen previously, and I was still talking to people as if that was helping, and it wasn't. And it was my sister actually who said that I needed to get some professional help with an organization who specialized in that sort of addiction. And I even protested, like when she suggested that. It's kind of, people talk about cognitive dissonance, and that's how far I was gone, really. That I was saying, oh no, I'm in this counseling and it is helping. Mm. And this was just after I'd had to leave like our family home because my wife had found out that stuff was still going on that I'd said on numerous occasions wasn't. And I was saying to my sister, no, I'm seeing this counselor, it's still working. And she's like, well, it's not, is it? And it's so odd to kind of think about it now, how wrong you can think about things and how, totally messed up in your thoughts you can be. So it wasn't until that point. And when I started that journey with that therapist, he in a series of questions at the beginning of that therapy asked various things. And one of them was, have you ever experienced trauma in your life? And I said, no. It was, you know, when people go through a long list of questions, which is like, have you done this? Have you done that? Have you taken drugs? Have you done that? And I was like, no. And he was like, have you experienced trauma? And I was like, no. And he just paused, he just stopped. And he was like, are you sure? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, because I was thinking in my head, I was thinking about, I don't know, my parents dying when I was a kid. He said, don't you think that losing your sight was a traumatic experience? Mm. And I said, no, not really. Mm. And he said, oh, I think a lot of people would. And he left this really long pause. And I didn't really want to get into an argument. So I said, I don't know, maybe. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But I honestly, like, I didn't really think it was. But then as we started this kind of therapeutic journey, it all kind of started to make loads of sense. So yeah, it was very late on in my life, relatively late, when I came to that conclusion. I didn't even come to it, you know, where someone helped me to understand.
I'm very struck, it was your sister, you know, that just almost like one word suddenly. And that's fascinating. One word can change the perception of a situation.
Yeah. And I was full of judgment. I was like, my sister's not a Christian. Mm. We're very different, have different attitudes about all kinds of things in life. And she said, you've got to go to rehab. And I was just thinking, oh my gosh, she's just talking about just what she's like seen on TV or something.
Yeah.
It was her. And she found this organization and she phoned them up and like got me to phone them. And my parents paid for my first couple of months of therapy with them. Yeah. It was absolutely down to her that it all started to happen.
I'm intrigued. A number of times you've used the word shame, that Shame's almost a shameful word, isn't it? To, you know, in Christian circles, shame being the difference between, you know, it's not you've done a bad thing, or we've done a bad thing, or I've done a bad thing, but I am a bad thing. You know, and that is sort of moving from an activity to a state of being. And the realization of that has been, you know, it's just so important in the healing journey.
Yeah.
And shame's mixed so much into church language as well. I wonder in your head, because you said very, very early on, you'd had this trauma, as you came later to realize, a traumatic experience in your childhood. You coped with it with faith to begin with, but realized there was an addiction thing, addiction coping going on at the same time. I wonder in what ways your faith then, did your faith come back in terms of your healing from the addiction?
What do you mean later through when I was having the therapy and stuff?
Yeah, so tell me about the healing journey bit, because it's involved the therapy and the rehab and so on, but you mentioned earlier running, and I wonder if that's been part of it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So I guess it was, I guess it's at first faith was really important. I mean, faith has always been important, but I suppose my inherited faith was a kind of quite evangelical, charismatic faith. And to start with, in my recovery journey, I kind of doubled down on that. So I prayed in tongues for an hour every day for about 3 months. And I prayed for an hour or more on top of that. And I journaled and wrote all kinds of things about who I wanted to become, and yeah, all of this kind of stuff. But as my therapy continued and as my recovery continued, I suppose there were certain questions that began to arise to do with my understanding of God as it was, and how that correlated to my experience of recovery. And almost by accident, around this time, I started to run, and through the influence of some close friends, started to run further and further, and then really got into like ultramarathon running. And in the recovery, sort of my journey with therapy was that I started seeing a therapist every week. And then after 2.5 months, he led a sort of residential week-long group therapy thing. And then it continued for another year and a half after that, sort of less, you know, fortnightly and then monthly. And during the residential experience, there was a mantra which was, you can't kick an addiction without changing your life. And running became the life change for me, because I think what happens, and what had been my experience previously, if you stop doing something that has been an addiction, you've got so much time and space in your head, and so much of your energy and thought has been given to this addiction, that suddenly there's this massive vacuum left. And if you don't fill it with something, it's very difficult to, you know, to move on. And so running became this massive tool in my recovery. So I always talk about therapy and recovery. So therapy at first helped me to develop tools to stop doing what I was doing. So we did all this kind of stuff around change, like disrupting your mind processes. So I moved desks at work. I shifted furniture around in my house. I would do all these different things, multi-sensory approaches when you're triggered. So smelling something, listening to something, moving, all of this stuff, which in the short term really helped me to stop. But moving from that place to a place where you kind of experiencing like a more full recovery was all about getting to the depths of what lay behind this behavior. So that's when we started to explore all these issues. And that's where my understanding of shame started to develop, in that I started to understand that my eyesight and my fear and anxiety and lack of control and self-loathing and insecurity at that young age in my adolescence had all contributed to this behavior that was soothing, anesthetizing, became addictive and became just hard baked into my personality. And within all of that, I was kind of left wondering what my faith, how my faith like played into that, because I'd been really passionate about Jesus since I committed my life to him as a 9-year-old, helped to lead a youth group in my teens, started preaching, reading the Bible, going on mission trips, studying theology at uni, playing the drums in a Christian band, being a youth minister, leading small groups. Yeah. And it was like, I was left just wondering why God hadn't done something before then. Like, why hadn't God stepped in and saved my marriage? Like, why hadn't God done things that, why hadn't God brought an understanding that I was now beginning to get through the therapy before it was too late? Because it felt like it was a bit too late because my marriage had ended and that was sort of everything. And for a long time, I found it really difficult to think about the future with much optimism or joy, because it was like, well, the most important thing in life is over. So like, what's left? And I guess that the story of the last 6 or 7 years has been a sort of journey of like rediscovering faith, of a deepening, like broadening understanding of faith and spirituality that I've been forced into because the previous one didn't really fit with my experience.
I'm really struck about that it was running, that it was the addiction that replaced the other addictions, not, you know, I don't know, tiddlywinks. Because, you know, your blindness was caused, as you said earlier, by genetic variation in your mother's womb. I'm curious about, you know, when anyone has a serious medical issue and they're a Christian, that bit of the Psalms that said, I was wrought in my mother's womb, you know, slams you against the wall in a way, because if you were wrought in my mother's womb, why, you know, why has this been laid down for me at such an early stage? How do I hold that together with an idea that I'm loved and beloved by God? You know, it's like, it's a crucible test, isn't it? Because, I mean, the whole of life is figuring out why bad stuff happens to good people, right? Mm-hmm. Or what goes on. But, you know, especially with a genetic thing that you were given this before you were even born to cope with. Like, my cancer was a genetic before I was born, and it was sort of on the cards, as it were. So it was in your body. And then it was a bodily thing, like running, that helped in your recovery. Mm-hmm. How much is the running about reclamation of your body and your whole identity as a blind man?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that the thing about running is that it's very embodied, and it very much has to do with a sense of control and power and achievement and flourishing and health, and I guess it's for me, in some ways it's like a meditative thing, because when I run, you've just got a lot of time and space, especially when you're doing long runs, you've got a lot of time and space. So if I'm running on my own, then I'll run on a treadmill in my garage, and I sometimes listen to podcasts, but I listen to a lot of music, and sometimes I can just let my mind go and just chew things over, or just, you know, just be just like in that meditative state where you're just like observing your thoughts and letting them form and unform and all that kind of stuff. But then it's also massively embodied, and it means that my eating becomes that much more vital, and you're eating to fuel or refuel, or and it changed me physically. So I guess I remember doing this exercise on that residential where we had to draw a picture that represented us as a young teenager. And through doing that, I realized that my perception as a young teenager was that I was like fat and stupid and couldn't see very well. And it's weird and it's odd. And I know that's irrational because I was quite intelligent and I wasn't that fat. I wasn't like fat. I was just a bit, I wasn't like slim and athletic, but I had that perception. And I realized that I'd carried that all the way through. So I don't know. It's a bit of an open question in some ways, because as I've thought about this kind of stuff, so I feel great about myself now because I'm slim and athletic. I don't know whether, is that healthy? Is that more healthy than coming to terms of being like a different shape? I don't know. Maybe I've just bought into something that isn't so healthy. But I do. I literally... My confidence, my self-confidence grew as I, amongst other things, lost loads of weight, became really fit, was able to run like long distances. And the sense of, even though I run with a guide, there's something about it that just feels so empowering. When I was a teenager, my dad's a really keen cyclist. So I used to ride down a tandem, but I never got the same feeling and everyone's different. So for me, it's running. Like, other people hate running, and I'm not necessarily an evangelist for running. But I think the difference, for example, with cycling is that even though I'm holding the other end of a strap as someone runs next to me, it's me doing it all, and it's I'm putting in that effort and I'm running that distance. And whereas I didn't really get that when I was kind of bolted onto the back of my dad when I was on a tandem. But yeah, it's very embodied, and it is interesting that it's that experience which has brought me so much healing and peace and joy. Yeah,
because we're embodied creatures, aren't we? Mind, body, spirit. Mm. There's plenty of quotations. We have one's out of kilter, and I'm not saying anything about weight, and I could do with losing a few pounds myself. It's not about that. It's about being comfortable in your body. It's really part of our whole person approach to health. And you know, and I when I had severe depression, I took up running mostly to escape my own children. But don't tell them that, like my new hobby, I have to go and run. But I really found it grounded me and made me feel, well, God, if I can do that, you know, that's that gives me confidence in other areas of my life. Mm. And I want to come back to, you've mentioned anger a couple of times. I have to say, Nick, I did a bit of research before I chatted to you, and I found a quotation. So if I could just quote something you said back at you, because it really struck me as like, well, this is it in a nutshell. And I just think this is so powerful in terms of the healing ministry. You're talking about, being blind and healing. You said, God's never healed me, but he stopped me from feeling self-pity. That used to be your testimony. Mm. My way of coping with that is tremendously positive. And you talked in this podcast about that. But this is what you said. Actually, I would say to you now, I hate being blind. It's awful. It's terrible. I wish I wasn't blind. I hate it. But in accepting that I don't accept it, in sort of being honest about how crap it is, I'm much more confident and comfortable as a blind person. And I just thought this is the most extraordinary quotation. I sort of, this needs to be like the strap line for the church. It's like just being radically honest about stuff when things are hard. Stop pretending things are easy because we're a friend of Jesus is in itself healing.
Yeah.
Just being able to express it is healing.
Yeah.
Has it gone any further for you? Do you think that anger that you talk about there is carrying you through in a positive way?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd say anger now. I don't know if I'm angry, but I still hate being blind. Mm. Yeah. But I never understood that. Like I said earlier, as a kid, I used to think that if I fell into self-pity, that's where I'd stay. Mm. So there were times, I can think of literal mornings or evenings where as a teenager or in my early 20s, where I'd experienced a real kind of grief about my eyesight because of something that would happen. But then I'd get up the next day and I'd slam on a Soul Survivor CD and I'd sing and pray and get myself feeling happy again. And I had that real feeling that if you you know, you can't let things get to you, because if you do, you know, you'll laugh or cry, and you don't want to be crying all the time. And so again, so whether it was like worship and prayer, whether it was doing, you know, speaking from the front of church, whether it was through telling funny stories about things that had happened to me because I was blind, it was always that kind of positive way, because I thought that was the only way of coping with it. The kind of dramatic realization is that by admitting or realize, see, I didn't even realize that I hated being blind. I didn't even know that was inside of me. It had been suppressed so deeply because of everything that I've talked about. I didn't know it was there. So again, I had this moment in a park one Saturday morning, and it was, we were still married at the time, but it was kind of coming to the end. And, saw this guy in the park, and he shouted across to his kid, and we chatted to him briefly. And I just thought there was everything about him represented sort of like, like my idea of masculinity. Like, he was friendly, confident, tall, had a deep voice, and he shouted his kid from the other side of the park. And I couldn't do that. My children were very small at the time, and whenever I went to the park with them on my own, I was petrified that they would wander off and I wouldn't be able to find them. So we only ever went to one park where hardly anyone went, and where there was only one gate out, so I just guarded it. I remember sitting there thinking, I'd give anything to be that man. I'd give anything to be him. And then I realized, it was, you know, how thoughts kind of just tumble out really fast. And then it was like, oh my gosh, I hate myself. I hate this. And then it was like falling into this black hole. And then all this grief and anger and pain And people have touched on it. There've been moments of it being touched on in the past, but it never come out. And I suppose in the therapy, and like, say that therapist saying, have you experienced trauma? And me saying, no. And is your eyesight, you know, losing your sight a trauma? And I said, no, I don't think so. And it was what I realized now, that is it, like you talk about radical honesty. If when I say I hate being blind, that's like accepting, well, what I said in that quote, accepting that I don't accept it has been transformative. And it's the honesty. And I think that goes in with the faith journey as well, that my faith journey has become one of honesty and being really honest in a way that I've not always. I grew up in a tradition where we talked about questioning things, and we talked about having a robust faith, but there were lines you couldn't cross, and there were things you couldn't say. And if you did say them, you were sort of, you know, going against orthodoxy or against the accepted truth. And so that's one of the hallmarks of my recovery, really, is about transparency and honesty and being real. And yeah, it's incredibly healing, because the truth is that I thought I was coping really well, and I thought I was doing a good job by putting a brave face on it. I didn't consciously think I was putting a brave face on it, but that's kind of what it was, and all that stuff was buried deep down. And if you bury stuff so deeply, you don't deal with it, and if you don't deal with it, then, as someone said, it will deal with you.
So how is your relationship? This is a really bizarre question. You said a wee while ago that, you know, you've begun this recovery process and engaging with your anger about your blindness and being honest with God, but, you know, your marriage has failed and your life's changed. And you said, you know, where is God now? Why now? What's God's answer to you now? Like, what's going on for you in your relationship with God now?
That's a great question. I don't even know. So how do I answer that question? What's going on in my relationship with God? I went running. I did a ultramarathon thing a few years ago, and I ran with someone who was a curate of a local church. So I did this marathon to raise money for Christian Aid, and I got different church leaders to run like a stage of it with me. So I'd like about 10 different church leaders over a couple of days. And one of the most profound moments was running with a curate who was quite overweight and had never run more than a mile in his life. And he ran 5 miles with me. And I told him my whole story, and he was really moved. And then when we finished, he was nearly in tears because he'd never run more than a mile. And quite a lot of people from his church came to like cheer him over the line. And it was just an amazing moment. And we shared. And you say about that kind of radical honesty as well. Sometimes people are, I mean, it's a real joy when your reputation has been so kind of destroyed that there's nothing left. So there's no need not to be totally honest. And what happens is that when you're totally honest, people find it really surprising and refreshing. And then they're much more honest with you. So I had this amazing conversation with him. It was really brilliant. But one thing he said to me about running, I was telling him, like I've told you about running being an important part of my recovery. He said, oh, that must be so good. And he was from a sort of fairly charismatic sort of tradition. He said, oh, so when you run, do you hear God? I bet you hear God speak to you, do you? And I didn't know how to answer that question. And it was a bit like not being sure how to answer your question about what's your relationship like with God. Because what I wanted to try and articulate, and I don't know if I'll do it now, but he said, when you run, do you hear God speak to you? And what I tried to explain was that the whole thing is God. It's not like that I run, and when I run, I listen, and then God speaks. It's more that in the running, in the stillness that it brings to my mind, or that space to process, in the music maybe that I'm listening to, in the visceral experience of like your muscles moving and your bones like hitting the ground and your body moving, in the experience of your like energy being sapped and you're kind of pouring yourself out physically and you're pushing yourself to the limit, or you're just enjoying a kind of gentle, you know, whatever it is. It's like that it's God. It's like the divine. It's like transcendent. It's peace. It's, you know, and you can talk about whatever, like endorphins, but it's the whole thing. And what I would say is like my relationship, what is my relationship with God like now? Well, it's sort of like, it's the whole thing. It's like, I think that I would say that I experience the divine and experience like presence in so much of my life. Like when it were like, if we were having this conversation like 8 or 10 years ago and say, what's your relationship with God? I'd say, oh yeah, it's great. I, you know, pray in the morning and I read my Bible and I do this. And when I worship this, and there would be these moments where I'd engage with God. Whereas now it's almost like the whole thing, I'm kind of realizing like it's in the whole thing. It's when I'm sitting having a cup of tea with my kids after my kids have just got into drinking tea, which I'm really proud about. So like when we have a cup of tea after our meal and it's like, oh, this is God. This is like, and when I'm like cooking some food, or when I'm like sitting in bed having a coffee and one of my cats is like sitting next to me in bed purring loudly. It's like, oh, this is, or when I'm walking the kids to school, or when I'm drinking a glass of wine with a friend. It's like that's how I would, and as well as kind of wrestling, like on Nomad, when we wrestle with like, you know, massive questions to do with, you know, stuff to do with the Bible or what we think about, like the big questions that you tackle here. It's that, but it's everything. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if that makes any sense.
You know that line, you know that Nick Cave song, God is in the house?
Right.
And it's got this line, will somebody let him out? Because it's got the image of God being trapped in a new church, white church,
and everything's neat and perfect in this little town, and nothing bad comes. The whole song is about let God out. God is in the messy bits of the city. Mm. And that's what came into my mind when you were talking. And it's deconstructionism, isn't it? But writ large in your life, we do it. It's going against compartmentalizing God in just little safe bits that are nice and curated and pretty for everyone to see. But ultimately, and I think that must be that some of, I mean, we've never met, have we, Nick, apart from right now.
Yeah.
You're telling me really profound stories about your life and people are going to listen to it. And that's a ministry, isn't it? And that's when people listen to radical honesty, like you've shown on this podcast, it liberates them. And hopefully they can find and a bit of peace. As well, yeah. As telling your story there, the way Bird Shalom peace was coming to me as you were telling your story.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think the greatest thing you see is that my life isn't, I thought when it all fell apart and I started my kind of road to recovery, I thought about being reconciled with my wife. And then when that became not, like, realized that wasn't going to happen, I thought about meeting someone new. And then there's all kinds of other things about, you know, like a lot of my identity was wrapped up in church and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm chatting to you now as a single divorced person who isn't in a relationship, who isn't in a leadership role in traditional church as I kind of understood it. And yet what I thought was never going to happen in terms of, like, experiencing a full recovery from, like, stuff that I was addicted to for most of my life has happened. And shalom is the word, because I feel that connection, that completeness, that holisticness, obviously in the midst of, like, sometimes feeling despair and grief and pain still, but it's incredible to think, I sometimes think I never thought I would ever feel this good without any of those things happening. And it's freedom. It's freedom. Because surely that is, like, that's the definition of freedom, isn't it? That you can ask anything and you can feel comfortable, like you were saying earlier, in who you are physically, spiritually, emotionally. It's liberating, and it's a journey. I'm still on it. Am I understanding, you know, I've got kind of shared with you my understanding of everything and my story as I understand it today. And that will continue to change and develop. But I think shalom is a beautiful way of putting it.
Nick, thank you so much for sharing your journey so far. And for being willing to tell us what you've been through. I hope God blesses you in your continued journey into peace and shalom. And also thank you for your work through the Nomad podcast. And if you're listening to this and you haven't listened to Nomad podcast, there will be links in the bio so you can follow Nick's work and the rest of the team over on Nomad. Nick, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's been great to be with you and share this. So yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
So that was my conversation with Nick. What did you think? It was, again, another really moving conversation, I felt. I felt like I was almost treading on holy ground chatting with him. His honesty, his openness left a lasting impression on me. So a huge thank you to Nick for your time and your openness in chatting with me on the Go Health podcast. So we'd love to know what you thought of the episode. The podcast is freely available to all, but we often pick up the conversation generated by the podcast in our Go Health community. It's our membership bit of the Guild. If you're not already a member, join us. It's just £4 a month, £4 a month, and you will get free training, free and discounted events, community connection, and a monthly bundle of resources. Pop over to our website, gohealth.org.uk, and scroll down to the Go Health community. Our tagline in the Go Health community is this: together we flourish. And that's what we try to do through the resources, the events, the conversation, everything. We try to connect together, to flourish for our good, but also for the good of the communities we live in the name of God. So yes, it's about self, it's about us, it's about our health and healing, but that's not the end unto itself. We do it because we want to connect into the world, make the world a better place. It sounds really kind of cliche, but it's so true. And my gosh, does the world need people trying to help others to flourish right now. Anyway, it's all over on the website. Check it out. Links in the blurb. Thank you to the amazing Wendy on the Isle of Mull for her production of this podcast. Again, please rate and subscribe. Why not share it on your social media streams? We want this conversation, like all our conversations, to reach as many people as possible. That would be amazing. So in the meantime, God bless. Let's connect and chat. Keep learning to heal because, as we say in the Go Health community, together we flourish.